Joe Jackman, there's a meme going around of how many homes have you lived in? And I think that the average is 4 or 5. I'm up to 14 and counting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, change is not unfamiliar to me.
Yeah, I've grown up in a family with 5 siblings, so 6 kids, and not one of us is born in the same city. So I think I came by the, I'm not sure affinity to change, but at least the comfort with it, simply because my dad was in retail and a part of his job for one long stretch was to open new cities or geographies for Sears. He would just move around in sort of a 2-year cycle somewhere in there. He'd get everything set up. He'd hire in staff. And then as a family would pack up and move on. So change yep. became sort of a habit.
And I call myself a radio brat. Because my dad was in broadcasting and you would move to the next bigger market in order to, you know, improve your career.
Oh, so. There you go. That, yeah. One of the things that's a benefit of that is, you know, connecting with people and finding a place within a new ecosystem. I actually think that experience is really, really valuable. But as you move from place to place and situation to situation, you're forced to just be able to adapt and figure out, okay, how do I thrive here? How do I connect with people? Yeah. And it's a life skill because, as you know, this is a moment when everything is changing. And change has been coming fast and furious for many, many years, many decades, but we've never seen anything quite like the pandemic. So, you know, talk about compressing, like, okay, everybody, let's do something a different way now. It's certainly shaping not just people's own lives, but it's shaping the dynamics of the marketplace, which I think actually personally, as well as professionally, in lots of ways to the better. But we might get into that in our conversation.
Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 37 of Insider Interviews, where you get the insider scoop on the business of media, marketing, and advertising. And today we're talking about what not too many people want to talk about, change. But my guest, Joe Jackman, is one of the foremost experts on the topic. As the CEO of Jackman Reinvents, reinvention company, Joe's been an advisor to consumer brands like Flow Water, retailers like Duane Reade and Staples, B2B companies, and even private equity partners for more than 30 years. And he's changed a bit himself, from designer to CMO and executive, and now he adds author to the list. Hear from this strategist who's helped leaders around the world use insights to change for the better. And just a reminder, if you're looking to change the way your company shares content, I hope you'll reach out to me at podcasts@mossappeal.com and let's talk about how I can help you add podcasting, white papers, all kinds of thought leadership to your arsenal. But now, here's my conversation with reinventionist Joe Jackman. So, Joe Jackman, if I say the word change, what a surprise, right? Mm-hmm. What comes to mind for you and for me, it's, and a lot of human beings, it's really like, ugh, not change. Mm-hmm. What about you?
Essential.
I didn't expect that. It makes sense, but I didn't expect that. I love it.
Yeah, if you're not changing and evolving, you really are stuck. That'd probably be the best scenario. But the more common scenario is you're moving backwards or, you know, in business terms, you're waning or dying. Mm. Change is, as never before, essential for us just to stay with what's happening. And unfortunately, it is the complete opposite to our comfort level as humans, which makes what you described as the more typical reaction the norm.
The ugh. Yeah.
The ugh. Yeah.
And so you call it reinvention. Tell me a little bit about how you have changed yourself over the years and some of your favorite gigs.
Hmm. Yeah. It's kind of a career that probably is defined by getting into something that and getting really curious and ultimately obsessed by that thing and wanting to do that and then going through the inevitable process, as we all do, of assessing whether that's possible. And for some reason or another, I was the youngest of 6 kids, and maybe I just got a wonderful upbringing with a positive self-image and a can-do kind of, hey, you can do anything you set your mind to. But I kept saying, well, why can't I do that? I'm going to jump and make a leap and I'll figure it out. And so to make that tangible, schooled in industrial design, realized while I love design and its power, potential, I was against peers that were just so talented. I thought, I better figure out how I can add value to what they do so well. And so I gravitated towards creative director and became one. Well, how? I just started my own business. And when you start your own business, you can, you know, you can decide what your role is going to be. But it worked out really well. And then eventually I cottoned on to strategy, call it lowercase s strategy, and said, why can't I be a brand strategist? What do I need to know? Who do I need to learn from? And then eventually evolving to my version of business strategy, which is in the world of management consulting, which I'm not one, but I just thought, look, why can't I shape strategy at the very highest level and have people in the end buy into it to a greater degree and therefore make it real? And then eventually one day, you know, with a client for a long time, and the president at the time, John Letter of Loblaw Company, said, I've got to do a bunch of things, refresh President's Choice, maybe a little repositioning. I've got to launch Joe Fresh and figure that out. I've got to, you know, create a real marketing and insight capability. And I thought, well, I have no business becoming a corporate executive. I didn't go to business school. I'm not experienced like my peers would be. And yet I thought, I'll never get an opportunity like this, and jumped in and, you know, went to retail exec boot camp and, you know, and learned. And then when I built my own company, because I thought, I want to build the company I wish I could have hired when I was the CMO or the executive vice president of Loblaw Companies Marketing. I built Jackman Reinvents and, you know, self-titled Reinventionist.
So what exactly are Reinventionists?
Like, what the heck is that? Well, it's a title, it's a word I made up, but it basically, the definition of which is to be a Reinventionist is to be just really, really good at making change happen and to great benefit. You know, the world needs more Reinventionists. We need to have people more fluid with the skills of making change and the mindset of making change.
Well, we're going to get into the features and benefits of change, but are people afraid of you? Are you like the last kid picked on the soccer team? Oh, there's that guy that wants us to change.
Yeah, exactly. That, you know, provocateur. Well, listen, I'll be a very, very honest, transparent marketer, Evie, and say, I read a book a long time ago by two authors, Trout and Reese, and it was very thin book called The 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. And one of the chapters was, if you can't be first in a category, create your own and become the leader. And I was really excited by that idea. And in a way, it led me to create my own company in a category I invented, which is the reinvention category. What I don't know, and I'll have to go back and read it someday, I don't know if they talked about how long it takes to actually create your own category. Because for at least a decade, people would say, oh, are you an agency? Not really. You know, we do agency-like things. Are you a management consulting firm? No, we have about a third of our team as management consultants, but technically, no, we're a strategy into action now people, and we've got a big creative team and so on. But everyone, rightly so, wanted to put us in a box. And the comparatives would be, well, we really need an agency here. We need a management consulting firm. We need a branding house here. Well, the actual fact is that we're all those things. We just figured out how to join them up and do the work of transformation, you know, consumer-facing transformation mostly, but sometimes B2B, in a super efficient way, which makes us different. And that's why we're in our own category of one. Well, you know, you push water uphill for a long time to get people to understand. Now, the world is in a crazy moment of change, and there's a lot more inbound emails. It took us a while to get what you're selling, but now we get it, and the timing is incredibly opportune. So
the world is your oyster now, as they say.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's that notion, you know, you can build it and they will come. The polarity is reversed. It's starting to come to us, which is fun. And it gives us choices. We don't do everything that comes our way, but we certainly get excited by significant change opportunities.
So talk more about how you invented Reinventionist.
So maybe I'll geek out for a second and just say what I loved about the concept of reinvention is that there's a couple of things embedded within that term. The first is the invention itself, that there was some creation, some vision. If it's a company that was started before, there was usually strands of DNA that were true beliefs, a belief system. And the act of reinvention is to not throw that away, but to actually make that relevant again. And I really like that idea. And as I think about change, obviously I've thought a lot about it because it's my profession.
Literally wrote the book on it.
Yeah, I guess, you could say that. Thank you for the book plug. But, you know, here's what I think we need to do collectively is we need to reposition the entire idea of change in our minds. Change is good. Change is a positive force. And it is, as I said earlier, essential. And it should be seen as creating the next best, most powerful version, the most relevant version of you or your company. And instead, it's seen as something negative. And look, if you want to resist change, have at it. But you know, the world is moving, consumers are moving, and you really not only need to stay with it to keep pace, but you need to find your place within that where you can thrive and become your most powerful and relevant. And so I would say, given the two alternatives, which would you choose? I've often said with a smile on my face, if anyone's going to create the next best version of me, it better damn well be me. Like, why wouldn't it be?
Right.
So, you know, otherwise you just sit on your hands and you say, look, I'm good here. I'm comfortable. I'm safe. And that can feel good, but ultimately it will bite you. And what's better than continuing to learn and broaden your horizons and figure out your next act? I'm always surprised when people say, look, change is hard. I know all the reasons why, because I've studied it and I practiced it with big companies and helping to transform them. But I think if people actually just took a second and thought about it, you'd choose change.
Absolutely. And especially when you put it that way, it almost makes me feel like the opposite of that, the status quo, is the thing that we should be saying, ugh, about.
100%. Yes. Okay. Yeah. In fact, one time at a conference, I was on a stage and I had just blurted out this expression. I said, the way I think about it, there's a serial killer on the loose and it's called the status quo and it's coming for every slow moving, you know, person and company on the planet. Well, I got a lot of feedback to say, that was a little dramatic, a little bit provocative. Well, you know, it's true. The history of business model life cycles, tenures of executives, the length of brands and their relevance and vibrancy, all of these things are compressing. We know this. This is not guesswork. This is in data. You know, the average life cycle of a business model is dramatically decreasing over the decades. And what's the average tenure of a marketing executive today?
Oh boy, like 18 months. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. So you either get with it and get good at it, like not just good, but pro athlete good at it, or you just have it done to you. And, you know, part of the culprit is the future. Let's, you know, future proof ourselves. Let's sort of do the things we need to do to set ourselves up for the future. When I was growing up, it was like this notion of the future was going to the moon and it was this far off place and it would come someday. And that's not the truth. The truth is the future arrives daily. And you need to either be part of it and actively hands-on shaping it for yourself and your business, or it's going to, you know, be done to you.
Yeah. So, I love that line, by the way, the future arrives daily. Oof. Well, it's, that's the future. And, that was the future. There's the future.
100%. Yeah. And it's funny with retailers, I've often respectfully said, let's not call it a store of the future. Because what that suggests, how many of those have I walked over the years and, you know, it was mothballed at some point, or like, what happened to this store? Well, you know, people didn't see it as real. And
right.
It was too expensive, and not everybody was aligned. And well, not everybody is aligned to the future. So let's just sort of think of it more granularly and figure out step by step, how do we continue to evolve, experiment, so that the future never arrives. It just simply is happening, and we're part of it.
Well, it also reminds me of a Honeymooners episode. Tell me, chef of the future.
Yeah, that's right.
But let's talk about retail a little bit. As you mentioned, you've got retail in your DNA. Your dad was at Sears, and you have been warning for something like 20 years that retail needs new concepts. And I want to applaud you for not only the case studies on your site. I love the example of, you know, what you've been aiming to do with Joann Fabrics and Staples. But apropos our conversation about the pandemic, let me give you a little shout out, and I'm going to read something about what you did specifically. The minute that Ontario, Canada allowed drugstores to offer immunizations, and this is back in 2012, you were the one to help then Rexall be the first chain to offer them. And it was literally a huge shot in the arm for them. Mm-hmm. So I'll keep going with the bad puns and ask, what prescription would you give any physical store today to help them survive in these downturn pandemic days of in-store shopping? Talk about retail and change.
Sure. Thank you. Well, first off, the credit goes to the Rexall team, and we were honored to be able to help them. And the story, without going at length, is that a relatively small, depending on where you were in the country, drugstore competitor was in the midst of a transformation and saw an opportunity to expand its offering beyond the physical with pharmacists at the back and a front store with pharmaceutical products and such to services. And the regulatory environment was changing. So when we finished the strategy work and the insights were so clear, what the customer wanted was a partner, not just in hard health, like prescription medicine, but in health and wellness. And that took us right to services. And we said, look, why don't we really get behind that? What was so stunning about that intention and then the execution of it was for a drugstore that had about 20% of the coverage or the footprint mm-hmm. of its much larger rival, it did, I think the number was 7 times its volume of immunizations. And really, it showed that scale and size versus competitors has no bearing on what your ability to achieve is. So I'd say today, that's the ethos that every successful retailer has to adopt, which is, what is our potential? What do we have permission to do and be? And then how, if we all get ourselves not only clear on that, but 100% committed and excited about pushing the edge of what's possible, it's remarkable what can be achieved. Here's the truth. Retail got lazy, and there are many exceptions to that comment, of course. But generally, retail sat and was lacking innovation, was either witnessing the coming e-com revolution and either ignoring it or choosing to sort of slow walk it. And a lot of disruption was enabled by that kind of sense that, oh, you know, maybe one day that'll evolve, but stores are the thing. And, you know, let's keep our eye on that. And then you name the category, everyone looked at that didn't have a legacy to protect, a business that was already built, and said, why don't we do it better? You know, mattress selling. Remember last time you were in a mattress retail experience? It was probably okay at best. But then along comes, right. You know, Casper and Endy and lots of players. And they just said, let's rewrite the script. Well, I look at Amazon, like many in the retail industry, as much as, you know, many fear them and are in awe of what they've been able to accomplish. If retail leadership was prescient in reading what's happening, Amazon wouldn't exist. Casper wouldn't exist. You know, Netflix wouldn't exist. There'd be a streaming service called Blockbuster. And we'd right. we'd all be using that. And our, you know, our smartphones wouldn't be called Apple. They'd be called Kodak. But this is the issue. We get into this idea that success, particularly over a period of time, is a very seductive force sponsored by the status quo. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. Let's not worry about those disruptors. They're a rounding error on our business. Let's not take any chances unnecessarily. This is the zeitgeist when you've been long successful. And what that says is, hey, everybody that's got a new way of doing things, come on in, because we're just sitting here waiting for you to steal our share.
Yeah.
Right. So let's get on with it. Let's actually disrupt ourselves. Let's figure out if there's one thing that I would recommend to a leadership team. I would say, if anyone can do anything, even in a small way, to take a chunk of your business, then you better be on that. And you better be not doing the calculus of, well, if that were to be true, we'd have to write off these kinds of assets, or, you know, that would cost so much to transform from what we are today to what we would need to become. Wouldn't you rather know that than have that happen? It's a mindset, hence the book. It's the reinventionist mindset. We just need to adopt a set of principles.
So speaking of mindset, I think that that is part of the Jackman reinventionist secret sauce, if you will. You really have your finger on the pulse, so to speak, of consumer research and insight. And I think that that's evidenced. I'm definitely going to point people to JackmanReinvents.com to see some of these case studies. And I cited before, like Staples, where you did some trial stores that almost were like a hybrid of a workspace and product sampling. And they even added a podcast studio. I love that, because all of that was about understanding what their consumer really wants. So what's in your crystal ball based on what you've learned that's really affecting brands right now?
Mm-hmm. So insights, you know, it's a term we're familiar with, often confused with research, which is the means to the end. What every business wants to know really is what matters now and what matters deeply to the consumers that we're focused on, or customers if you're a B2B business. And that is really an art and a science to find those nuggets that you can actually hang a strategy off of. And in the case of Staples, we did a lot of research. We did a lot of in-field work, just conversations, formal, informal. And what we discovered was what people really didn't care about that much was office supplies, which is a hard thing to wrap your head around.
We don't really need scotch tape anymore.
Yeah. I mean, we need supplies, of course, but the emotional attachment to office supplies is very low. But where there's high emotional engagement is with what are office supplies and related services? What are those all in the service of? They're in the service of achievement and learning and growth. And by virtue of Staples being an office supply superstore, what hadn't been surfaced was we actually play a central role, not to overstate it, but a fairly central role in people achieving their goals. And that we had the permission, because we were a trusted brand and well-known, maybe a little narrowly defined at the time, but we had the permission to help and to be partners on that working and learning and achievement journey. And that just changed everything. And this is the thing, insights are the raw materials of strategy. And so many companies say, we have a strategy. And one of the questions I'll always ask is, what's the strategy based on? And often it'll be just a little bit of crickets. So I would first say, look, there's probably only one rule in all of this work in transformation. And that is, you must deeply understand who your customers are and what they care about most. Not functionally, but beyond function into the world of emotion. And everyone has an end. The means are the ones that most marketers focus on. Understand what the end is.
Let's talk about how we impact change for media and content brands. People have a font of knowledge with you, Joe. So I'm going to refer them to your own podcast, The Reinventionists. And you did an episode with a very well-known media executive out of Canada, Andrew McLeod. And you talked about how media has been so disrupted especially in its ability to monetize. And yet, people's desire to consume trusted content is through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So my long-winded question to you is, what can brands communicate, particularly media brands, that's going to help drive trust and reassurance?
Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a very big question. What can they do to earn trust? This is an evolved definition. What is a brand? A brand equals purpose, elevated to experience, delivered consistently.
Ooh.
And so, purpose, let's start with the first part, is really, who are you? Why do you exist? Who are you to whom? And therefore, what do you stand for to them? Most companies haven't got that very well defined. And yet, if you look at the evidence, purpose-led companies tend to outperform their peers. There's a lot of case evidence on that. Elevated to an experience is that everything that you do, every communication, every touch point, everything experiential, having a conversation with a customer service associate or inbound, advertising, if everything is tied back to who you uniquely are and why you are, it has so much more power and relevance. And when it's connected, because it comes from the same place, so relatively easy to connect and make cohesive, it just gets more powerful, it gets more efficient. And then lastly, delivered consistently, in a quarter-by-quarter world where every marketer feels the pressure like every peer on a leadership team, it's so tempting to, let's try this, let's do that, particularly in a performance world.
But you know that I'm the editor of a publication called The Continuum, which is dedicated to talking about brand awareness and demand marketing. So you're very much for the brand and demand aspects of things, as long as it's built on the foundation.
Absolutely. Performance marketing, of course, today is very much in play, and it's important. It's important because it's data centric and it's measurable and we can adjust. So I'm all in favor of tactics of that kind and other kinds of tactics, as long as they ladder up to some higher order purpose. If the effect is we experiment, we change, and there's nothing that holds them together. There's no red thread that links these things. It feels like I'm dealing with a different company today than last quarter or last year. That's not good. You can't build trust. And the second thing is maybe more human in its perspective, and that is, I think every company, every marketing leader should really think carefully about putting a filter on what they do, because today's measure of success is this truly a relationship I have with this brand? Do I feel like I'm part of the same community? Now, if I'm a person and I'm meeting someone new or I'm starting to build a deeper relationship, I'm going to want there to be a certain level of respect and maybe empathy in some regards. And I find that a lot of the automated world of marketing is just completely tone deaf. If I met someone and, they sent me 5 messages in the first week, let's say I'm dating, I'd say, oh, okay, maybe this isn't going to work out. Like brands need to behave in human ways. And that takes a different discipline. It takes a different approach to making sure that you come across as genuine and true. You're always the same consistently at the core. You can evolve certainly in how you communicate, what you have to talk about, but to be very, very true and uniquely yourself, that's how you build relationships. And then, of course, all the tactical ways to connect. I mean, wonderful. 20 years ago, we didn't have the dashboard, the toolkit. And today we have so many ways to do it. I just say, let's be thoughtful. Let's do it well.
So you have to have that foundation, and that foundation is in fact built on the DNA, those brand value strands that you talked about in the beginning, and that has to build up your awareness marketing, and then you can use performance or demand marketing to reach that target audience over and over in different ways.
As long as there's a real linkage between those ideas, because if it's all demand, the risk is that it won't add up to anything that's going to be sustainable.
Well, you've said that we're in a values economy Is that why? And will those values help us, help us overcome our cancel culture and that fear of, you know, that consumer piss off? What do we do?
Yeah. So the values economy, by that I mean for your listeners and readers, is simply the shift from value, quality over price, historically how consumers made purchase decisions, which doesn't go away. It's just that it's being overshadowed by something bigger, and that's the values economy. And by that I mean that more and more, and there's just enormous body of evidence that shows this, that consumers are choosing the brands that they associate with, the products and services they buy on the basis of values. And values might come in the form of, you know, I really like this company. It has lots of great things to offer and is a pretty good brand. I get, you know, quality over price, and that all ticks the box. But I really don't like the way they treat their employees. I don't think they keep them safe in a pandemic, or, you know, I've been reading articles about how they underpay them and overwork them. There is a lot of deselection going on today in the consumer real time on that basis. Environment and sustainability. We've long talked about it. You know, I'm involved with Flow Water, a sustainable water, certified B Corp. It does a lot of things right. Not perfect, but a lot of things right. And consumers are saying, I really might like Fiji or Evian, but I don't want to choose glass bottles shipped from the other side of the world or plastic bottles any longer. And so I'm going to deselect them on a values basis because I might care about sustainability or climate change more broadly. And I'm going to select an alternative. And, you know, fortunately, it's Flow, which is an incredibly fast growing premium alkaline water sustainable packaging, right? So that's what values economy is. But let me tell you what is leading to the shift that we're seeing. These trends that I'll speak to have been going on for a better part of a decade, but now in a pandemic context are really noticeably rising. Things like, I need to know who you are and what you stand for. I need to understand if you have values that are compatible with mine. I need to know that your footprint in all regards is reasonable. I also need to know that some of the beliefs and pursuits that you as a brand have resonate with me. Because in a world of choice, and this is what the internet did to retail, because retail was relatively slow to adapt and adopt, but in a world of infinite choice, when everything becomes equal, there's only two tiebreakers. One of them is price, which, you know, unless you're the low-cost player, price is a problem because, you know, you'll just get commoditized and your margin disappears. But the other tiebreaker is how you feel about the brand. And every indicator today points to be more and mean more to people, and you'll ultimately sell more to them.
Well, I was going to ask you for a little hint from your book, The Reinventionist Mindset. I know that you offer a framework of five keys to change. I think you just teased up a few of them there. Anything else you want to add, or did we touch on most of them?
Well, most of them. I mean, I won't go through them all, but they're fundamental things. And it's funny because, look, I'm a longtime creative person and marketer. And even I sort of gag at the packaging of, you know, I've got five principles, they add up to the reinventionist mindset. You know, it's like, oh my God, another, you know, five principles or 10 or whatever. But look, here's what happened. Over 15 years since I left an executive position at a big retailer, Loblaw Companies, I got the opportunity to help leadership teams transform their businesses. Sometimes incrementally, sometimes really bold, you know, swing for the fences because we're screwed if we don't situations. And I'm well north of having helped 50 companies now. And along the way, I noticed something very, very deeply human. And the cut line underneath the title of the book, The Reinventionist Mindset, is learning to love change and the human how of doing it brilliantly. And the human how is really this. We're wired as humans to behave in certain ways. And we were talking about one of the things we don't love is change. And what I noticed in the transformation, you know, leadership teams under pressure, and whether that was Walgreens or Hertz or all these various companies, Duane Reade back in the early days, and there was a way of thinking and doing that enabled success to come faster. And so I just started writing notes as I was going, and then I distilled those down to like 8. And then, you know, with the help of my team, I got them down to 5. And each are 2 or 3 words, and they just simply get to a mindset of how to become great at change. Mm. For example, the first one is seek insight everywhere. We tend to get very insular in our world, right? If you're in the apparel business, you pay attention to what's going on in apparel. But look, Uber did more to impact our expectations around customer experience and transparency and ease of interface. And it changed everything, banking, supermarket, shopping expectations, et cetera. So, you know, widen the aperture, pay attention to people that you're maybe not focused on. For example, here's a classic. There's a religion around, I need to pay attention to the customers that I do the most business with. Of course, it's a great discipline. You also need to pay attention to the ones that are behind them, that are coming up. Because if I've heard one refrain, EB, over the years, it's in talking with customers about a brand that I happen to, you know, be engaged with. And they'll say, oh yeah, that brand, I love that brand. You know, my dad used to take me to that brand. Or yeah, that they used to have all sorts of great stuff back in the day. Yeah, I haven't thought about them for a while. Listen, if you're not paying attention to younger people, like seriously, and thinking about how they're going to ask you to evolve, you're basically at risk. And the risk is getting greater every day and every week that goes by. So the way I think about it is, you don't want to be, as a brand, as a business, a great aunt, you know, fondly thought of but never visited.
I want to kill myself right now. And I'm saying that to my nieces and nephews.
You know, but you know, and it's funny, in that personal context, you'd say, listen, being with it is to be able to have conversations with them that are relevant to them, you know, not telling stories from the past that they go, oh no, here we go. So it's currency. And so importantly, it's cultural currency. You know, Seek Insight Everywhere, when I thought that is a fundamental principle, I started to read magazines that I would never normally pick up. I started to watch movies that younger people were watching, because I thought, I just need to know, what are the nuances that matter? And that's currency, right? Currency right. in the cultural sense, but it's also currency in the financial sense.
And that is the whole excellent rationale and need for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those different mindsets that help inform a broader perspective and help us communicate to a broader swath of people than just our own darn selves. Joe, I'm going to just leave you with one question, and it's a zinger. Pandemic aside, what would you most love to see change in the world?
Mm. Well, I'll take a page from one of my own podcast guests, Marian Benacram, who now is the chair of Reporters Without Borders and a longtime marketer. She was the global CMO of Hyatt and other places, came out of the news business in marketing. And her answer to that question was democracy itself. And I love that. Look, I never got to your question on cancel culture, but why is cancel culture a thing today? A lot of people would point to social media as the platforms that enable that kind of response and dynamic. But I would say more fundamentally, it's the polarization of society. It's the degree to which we are pulling apart rather than coming together. And it is rooted in, I believe, fundamentally, a feeling that change is hard, so better to protect what we have. Call it white and people of color dynamics in the world today, and particularly in the United States. I mean, what is that? That is essentially people fearful of something and trying to protect something they know. And so I think we need to find a way to reinvent democracy so that there is a stronger love and appreciation for the value of it, and a way to engage in it that is just different than is happening today. And then I love Michael Graves, the designer that did a lot of work for Target and many other businesses. And when asked, what's your favorite project? He said, the next one. You know, what do I want to reinvent? The next company that interests me that I've lost its way, or a new company like Flow Water that says, I want to reinvent a category. I want to reinvent water. And there's so much of that. Like, how wonderful to spend a career on just figuring out what's the next act of whatever. So, but thank you for that question.
Thank you for reinventing so many things to all of our greater good.
Well,
not the least of which is water.
Yeah, well, you know what? We all need to do something. And I'm very, very serious about finding opportunities to do things that count in regards to climate change. Some of the folks I'm talking to today, it's not that they're going to do things differently and like leave one profession or career focus and jump to another. What they're going to do is make sure that their career focus ends up with net benefits. And climate change is real, and we have to start to make a difference. So those are the kinds of opportunities I'm gravitating towards now, and super excited to be at least part of the solution as best I can.
What a great answer. Joe Jackman, thank you very, very much for being on Insider Interviews. And this will also appear on The Continuum in journalistic form.
I can't wait to read it and probably wince a couple times at, oh, yeah, I said that, did I? But thanks. You make it very easy, Evie.
Well, I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. If you enjoyed this content, please feel free to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/MossAppeal. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on social media and let me know if you have a question or a suggestion for a next stellar guest in media, marketing, and advertising. Speaking of stellar, my theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. Thanks again for listening.